Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Dave Schrader, your host for this evening. We have an interesting show lined up for you this evening, a show that years ago you might have sat back and thought, would these topics ever need to even be brought up? But with what's going on the news on a weekly basis and stories that are cropping up, it seems like it's a good time, as good a time as any, to turn the focus onto some very hard discussions. And we've got that lined up this evening. In the first 2 hours of tonight's show, James Trainum will join us. How the police generate false confessions. You have the popularity of the Netflix series Making a Murderer, starring or dealing with the case of Stephen Avery and his nephew Brendan Dassey, which captured the attention of the world earlier last year. And they're in the midst of filming the next part of the series, and news breaking about Brendan Dassey and his confession and what it means, and that he may be released within the next 90 days. There are cases like the famous West Memphis 3, an entire case that hinged on a confession by a young man with a very low IQ who was, in some estimations, browbeaten and told that he would be able to, get a much lessened sentence if he just said what they needed him to say. And watching those documentaries, it certainly is chilling to think that some people are put into positions where it's easier to admit to a crime they did not commit in order to get some freedom, to get the chance to go home for the night or go to bed or stop feeling like they're being cornered. How is that even possible? Who in their right mind would ever confess to crimes they did not commit? Yet we hear stories of that. As a matter of fact, the Innocence Project, which there's one in every state, estimates that there could be upwards of 100 people in every state that are serving time for crimes they did not commit, but in most cases were forced to admit to in order to reduce the penalties that they were facing. So we'll talk with James Trainum about that. Then a little later on in the show, for the last 2 hours, we'll be joined by Dr. Joe Alton. And again, a topic I never thought would be important to chat about, but it seems that with everything that's going on in the world around us right now, this may be one of the most important shows we've had a chance to do in a long time. What do we do in the event of a mass shooting? How do we survive? What can we do proactively to make sure that our chances for survival are much greater, much higher? We'll discuss that with Dr. Joe Alton. We'll take phone calls throughout the evening that you may have questions, concerns for our guests. We'll deal with that. All right, sit back, turn on the lights, turn up the radio, and stick with us because tonight is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Coast to Coast AM. James Trainum is a retired officer from the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C., as a violent crimes case review project director and detective from 2000 to 2010. He was the recipient of the Marymount University Forensic Psychology Program Award in Ethics in Law Enforcement in 2005 and recipient of the 2009 Innocence Network's Champion of Justice Award. Trainum has written several articles on interrogations and the creation of innocence commissions, committees designed to review alleged wrongful conviction cases. He's been interviewed on the topic of interrogation and false confessions by The New Yorker, New York Times, and National Public Radio. Trainum has also been quoted in the American Psychological Association's white paper on the topic of false confessions, and in numerous other articles and editorials. He speaks at many conferences and other events to talk about the topic of false confessions and interrogation techniques. He's here this evening to talk to us and is the author of How the Police Generate False Confessions. James, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you for having me. From your introduction early on, it sounds like you covered just about every topic I was going to, so very good.
Well, thank you. I'm fascinated, as many people are, by true crime. And certainly there is a niche for it because there is entire networks dedicated to covering crimes and what goes on during everything from the minute of the crime through interrogation, through prosecution. And more it seems that these stories of false confessions, these flags keep popping up. And I don't think a lot of people really fully understand what a false confession is, how it happens. How do you get people involved in admitting their own crime, and why? Now, unless somebody's tortured or mentally incompetent, why would people confess to a crime they did not commit, James?
Well, the answer I've always given to that is think, if you committed a crime, if you really did the crime, and you were knew that you were facing the potential of maybe 30 years to life in jail or even a death penalty, why would you confess that you did it? Like I said, even if you did do it. I mean, what is it in the interrogation room that we do that creates the perception that that's a good idea? And actually, what we do is we kind of create this temporary perception that it's in your best interest. If you want to escape an inevitable consequence and receive some sort of benefit, then you're going to have to tell me a version of the story that I, as the detective, believe to be true. And the perception that, you know, people have that they would never confess to a crime that they didn't commit. Oh, yes, they would. It just depends on the right circumstances and the right buttons that need to be pushed at the time.
Let me ask you about this. I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, shows like Making a Murderer on Netflix blew up. I mean, and it burned across the entire world of people fascinated by this case of Stephen Avery, who was wrongfully convicted of a crime, then released and then found guilty of another even more heinous crime, along with his nephew, Brendan Dassey. Now, Brendan Dassey, the news is coming out that his conviction may be overturned, or actually has been overturned, and there's 90 days for the state to decide what they want to do with this case. How familiar are you with the case of Brendan Dassey and this quote-unquote false confession that he was a part of?
I'm pretty familiar with it. I've watched most of the confession itself, or most of the interrogation and the confession that they put up on YouTube and all that.
With what you've seen and what's been made available to us as viewers, do you believe that what the police did and how they engaged in that interrogation yielded a false confession, or do you believe that it's being slanted so that it looks that way to market better for a program?
Well, when you, I kind of stay away. This may sound kind of funny based on the topic, but a lot of times it's hard to tell absolutely positively for sure if a confession is false or not. So what I do is I look at the reliability of the confession, whether or not, one, it's accurate, and two, whether or not you can trust it because the information is actually coming from the suspect themselves and is not being fed to them by the police officer. First off, when you look at the interrogation process that got him to the point where he decided that it was in his best interest to confess, they did so many things that the leading interrogation schools and the researchers pretty much say you shouldn't do. You should not box somebody in with any kind of real or perceived threat of inevitable consequence, like telling them that it's inevitable that they're going to be convicted no matter what. And then you don't offer any kind of promises of leniency or help or things along that line. And that's what you see happening during this interrogation. Something else about what you see is how vulnerable, you know, Brendan is. I mean, he has certain cognitive disabilities that are very clear in the conversation. And then what I think really shocks most people is how at the end he's manipulated. He obviously doesn't know. He knows that he needs to tell these detectives what they want to hear, but he doesn't know what it is. And you can see the detective's frustration, you can see his frustration, and you can see as he guesses. And they feed him information. In fact, at one point, it was funny because I was watching it with my wife, and she started, you know, hitting me because I was mouthing what the detectives were going to say before they even said it. But they basically said, "No, look, we are at the point where, you know, we're frustrated. let me just tell you, you know, did you shoot them or whatever like that? That's when you get that sort of contamination, then there's no way to tell whether or not the person is actually telling you what they know for sure, or they're just parroting what the detective wants them to say.
I'm curious. I mean, if TV was able to show that aspect of the interrogation, you can see that they were obviously doing it the wrong way. How was that even admissible to begin with?
Well, the thing about it is that for decades now, I mean, for longer than that, the courts have gotten away from worrying about whether or not a confession is reliable. And all they have been focusing on now is primarily, is it admissible? And the admissibility hinges mostly on things like whether or not the person was read Miranda or whether or not they were in actual custody at the time. Miranda, where it was designed to help protect the innocent and help protect people from what the courts have recognized are very, very coercive interrogation techniques. What it's actually done is given law enforcement a means by which, once we get them past that Miranda hurdle, a lot of courts will let us do almost anything, and they will still consider that confession to be admissible. So that's the issue right there. If they look at Miranda, did they knowingly waive Miranda? Oh, yeah, they signed the thing, so therefore, shame on them. They can be subjected to these very coercive tactics.
Can you explain to us with what happened recently with this judge overturning the conviction and giving it 90 days for the... First of all, I'm curious, as if a judge has overturned the conviction, why was Brandon Dassey not set immediately free? Why are we giving the court systems another 90 days to decide what they want to do if we're playing with a man's innocence? And he's already served 17 years for this crime that the judge thinks, you know, he shouldn't even be in for. Why is this taking so long?
Well, first off, I'm not a lawyer, so I therefore may misspeak a little bit on this. And each jurisdiction is different. But just because they overturned the conviction doesn't mean that they're saying that he's innocent. They're just saying that the government now has another chance, or that he deserves another trial. And so I guess in a sense of fairness to the government, they have to give them a certain amount of chance, a time to decide whether or not they're going to go forward with this case. In other jurisdictions, they would do it differently. But I'm just assuming that that's the law up there.
If my understanding is correct, with the overturning of this conviction, what the judge has also said is that the courts, the state has a chance to retry this case and do so at their own discretion. However, they're not allowed to now use this confession that Brendan Dassey gave, which, I mean, if you're removing that opportunity, and that was the thing that the entire case hinged on, how do you win a conviction again when your biggest asset is taken away from you?
In my opinion, from what I know about the case, it's going to be extremely difficult for them. Unfortunately, in cases like this, what happens a lot of times is that suddenly jailhouse informants start popping up out of the blue, which is a whole nother topic altogether, but I do cover in my book. And, you know, jailhouse informants are infamous for making up so-called confessions that they've heard from their cellmate or their inmate. And when there's a high-profile case like this, they just swarm to the prosecutor's office hoping for some kind of deal on their own case. And I'm sure that could very well be happening here. And if the government decides to go forward with this case by using the jailhouse informant, then that jailhouse informant really needs to undergo an awful lot of scrutiny. But that's like right. The only way that I can see.
Well, and that kind of, again, you're talking about looking for reliability. You know, when you realize that now you're relying on somebody who's trying to bargain to get themselves out of trouble or lessen their sentence, how do you even start taking that, how do you even take that into account as a reliable source?
Well, it's like the old saying that extraordinary claims call for extraordinary cooperation. And we have been way too lenient with jailhouse informants in the past, mm-hmm. and they have, in and of themselves, led to an awful lot of wrongful convictions. But you really have to scrutinize. It's just like I talk in my book about the steps that law enforcement needs to take to scrutinize any kind of witness statement, be it, you know, confessions, witnesses, victims, but especially informants. There are certain things that need to be done in order to test the reliability of that information. And way too often, we just don't do that. And that's how this bad stuff gets into the courtroom.
I think it's important to note, too, a lot of people are under the understanding that if Brendan Dassey's conviction is overturned and upheld, that that somehow affects Stephen Avery's case. But as my understanding is, Stephen Avery was tried without the admission, without the confession of Brendan Dassey. So his recanting of that admission, any of that information will have absolutely no impact on Stephen Avery's case. Is that the same understanding you have?
That is my understanding. It's like apples and oranges. He was convicted under a whole different set of evidence.
Right. So, and nothing that Brendan Dassey said was admissible in Stephen Avery's case. As a matter of fact, I believe Stephen Avery was found guilty before Brendan Dassey's case even came to trial. Came later.
If memory serves me correct, that's right.
Right. Okay. So you've got the media, you've got programs like Making a Murderer, you've got the shows following all these documentaries following the West Memphis Three and Jesse Miskelly, the young man who was a part of that group that had a severe mental deficiency. I think they said that he had, like, you know, maybe the mentality of a 10 or 11 year old boy when he went in there. And again, watching the video seems to have been coerced and manipulated into this very strange confession that he ends up giving. Are cases like this few and far between, or do we have a real problem out there?
Actually, I think that we have a much bigger problem than we realize, because, you know, even though they can show that we have, like, because the DNA exonerations that we've had out there, like, mm-hmm. 20-some percent of those involve some sort of false confession. Of the 1,800 or so exonerations that we've had over the last several decades, it's about 13, I think, percent. I think that's the right number, involve false confessions. But, you know, the thing about it is that these are cases typically where there are long prison sentences, and so there's a lot of energy and resources placed on exonerating these people when it comes to light that their conviction was probably false. You know, people who plead guilty to much lesser offenses, who plead guilty and get probation, or, you know, things along that line, you know, things that don't get all of the attention, then, you know, they go under the radar screen, and nobody really deals with their cases. And so, therefore, they're not counted in the number of false confessions that are out there. So the ones that we see is just a very small number of actually what's happening. But also, what I like to point out is false confessions isn't the total picture, because if you have a witness or an informant or even a victim who you feel as a detective is not telling you the truth, is holding something back from you, what you do is you switch from interview into interrogation mode, and you start using the very same tactics on that witness that you would on a suspect that has been shown to lead to false confessions. And then you also, unfortunately, and a lot of times unintentionally, then provide the witness with what you think that they should be saying to you. And the witness agrees, and thereby you get a wrongful conviction based off of false witness testimony. And about 20% of the wrongful convictions out there, so let's say different numbers differ from different, you know, places, of course. But false witness statements and bad informants are also leading causes of wrongful convictions. So
we need to take a break, James. We'll come back and we'll talk more about how police generate false confessions. And do we have safeguards in place to prevent false confessions? What can we do to protect ourselves and understand these things better? We'll continue that discussion with our guest, James Tranum, when we return to Coast AM. Thank you so much for hanging out with me this evening. And remember, if you miss any part of tonight's show or any of the shows, you start listening in that car ride home and you want to listen to the rest of the show, but man, it's so late. What are you going to do? Well, we've made it as easy as we possibly can for you. Well, you can set you up with a Coast Insiders membership. All you have to do is go to coasttocoastam.com, coasttocoastam.com, and become a Coast Insider for a one-year subscription. Breaks down to only 15 cents a day. That gives you access at any time to our archives, so you can listen to the last 5 years worth of shows and hear them in their entirety. All of the great content that you hear on the show that's late at night, as I say, you can wake up refreshed in the morning, take it with you, and listen on the go. Become a Coast Insider. You'll find out why we are the best in overnight talk radio. Go check it out at coasttocoastam.com. And if you love what you hear on Coast to Coast, you're going to love what you see on George's TV show, Beyond Belief. There's more information on Coast to Coast AM about that, or visit beyondbelief.com, beyondbelief.com, our TV show where we delve into these topics deeper and give you a visual representation of much of what you hear here on the show. This evening, we've got James Tranum for the first 2 hours, How the Police Generate False Confessions. We're going to discuss what really happens in the police interrogation rooms and how it's so easy for officers to generate false confessions. We'll do that when we return. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. The reasons that people falsely confess can be complex and varied. Throughout the book that we're discussing this evening, How the Police Generate False Confessions, our guest, James Tranum, encourages readers to critically evaluate confessions on their own by gaining a better understanding of the interrogation process. All right, James, talk to me about studies. I mean, has there been any real research done on false confession cases? And if so, what is that information yielding?
Well, what they're doing is there's two different types of research. There's research where they're studying actual confirmed false confessions. These are ones that they positively know were false, maybe because let's say no crime occurred, the DNA evidence excluded the person could not have been physically there, that sort of thing. So they study the tactics, they study those cases themselves, and they compare them to other cases. But they try to replicate the techniques that are used in an interrogation room in the lab to see how much they may increase the percentage of false confessions by using that technique. The problem with the laboratory studies is that it's very hard to isolate a single interrogation technique because they're all used in conjunction with each other. These real or perceived threats combined with real or perceived promises combined with lying about evidence, all of that could happen within the same paragraph, if not the same sentence. And so to take one, pull it out by itself, they've shown that by using these individual techniques, like lying about evidence, and that's a big one, that it does increase the percentage of false confessions, but it's just hard to translate that into what goes on in the interrogation room itself.
I've always been fascinated by the idea that when a crime occurs that they don't have a perpetrator for, how many people respond and take or admit to the crime having had nothing to do with it? What is the general consensus? What's the psychology of that? Do we have any idea or better understanding now of why people will call in and confess to this and confess to not knowing more about it?
Oh, like voluntary false confessions, you know, that sort of thing. They do happen. And in fact, it's funny because cops tend to be much more critical of a voluntary false confession than one that they obtain through coercion. I just think that's kind of interesting right there. But yeah, I mean, some people do it for notoriety. Some people will have voluntarily falsely confessed because they were trying to protect somebody else. In one case that I remember, there was a domestic murder where the mother murdered the daughter's boyfriend, but the daughter falsely confessed because she was a juvenile and she knew that she would get less time. So if you dig deep, the person is doing it for some sort of benefit, either for themselves or for somebody who they love or a gang member, that sort of thing. That's your typical voluntary false confession.
Do you have any estimation of how many people have been put away on something like that? Just they come forward, they admit to it, and have just enough information to be dangerous and agree to not go to court and will sign a confession so that, you know, can quickly be meted out and justice served. How many people do we have, do you believe, that are serving time for those kind of crimes right now?
And that's so difficult to estimate because, you know, first off, you have to identify that it was a voluntary false, but it was a voluntary confession, that it could potentially be false, that sort of thing. And that's the big unknown. We don't even know how many interrogations we do in the U.S. every year. We don't know how many confessions result from those interrogations. We don't know how many convictions result from those confessions. So, like I said, these are numbers that are just out there, and there's no way to really, you know, pin them down.
I think a lot of people don't realize, too, that some of the false confessions that end up being taken, they cop a plea deal so that they, you know, once the police have made this negotiation, we've got you, you know, your buddy's already flipped on you, even though nobody's flipped on them, and they've given information, and we know that you're involved in this, you might as well come clean, and if you drag this out, it's going to cause this problem or that problem. A lot of times they never, am I understanding this right? They never see a real day in court because they've basically waived their rights to that. They're just, you know, in order to not face the death penalty or face something, you know, traumatic along those lines, it's better for them, in their estimation, to sign saying, oh, yeah, I did this. You know, if this means I'll only go away for 15 years as opposed to life, I'd rather take that gamble at this point because they seem to think they really have me.
And that is the same dynamics that occurs in the police interrogation room. Most cases never go to trial. Most people who are charged with a criminal offense will plead guilty. And what it is, it becomes a cost-benefit analysis. It's like a business deal. It has nothing to do with the truth whatsoever. The government wants to get the case out from under them. The court wants to move the case along. For the defense attorney, it's an easy resolution. And so the person is faced. They're being told by the government, look, if you go to trial, this is what you're facing. However, if you want to cut your losses, you know, then you got to plea. And it's, you know, it might be that they're being held in jail without bond. They've been in there for 6 months. They're being told that if you plead guilty to a minor offense, you'll get time served and you'll get out tomorrow. They might be told by their defense attorney, look, if you go to trial, this is going to cost you $10,000 more. They just can't afford it. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, it's the same dynamics. They're trying to escape this inevitable consequence and get some sort of benefit. And it's a business deal, and they take it, even though they are not guilty of the crime.
This is what's so maddening to me, watching these shows and reading these books about cases where people end up being railroaded in, because it's the lesser of two evils. They can't afford court. They can't afford to fight and get the kind of protection they need, because unfortunately, let's face it, there are a lot of public defenders who are just not skilled enough to handle capital cases like that. And they're put into these hands. You know, Brendan Dassey is a prime example. The public defender in his case was unbelievably ill-equipped to handle that job. And that's, again, why the judge has looked at this case so deeply and wants to let it go. He feels he didn't get the representation he should have had. when are we going to start taking people's lives into account again, that they are innocent until proven guilty, and it shouldn't be a business venture of let's just cut the losses? When are we going to get back to let's find the real culprit, let's really investigate this crime, instead of let's go the easiest route and just get the guy that's, you know, that we have enough evidence to make him feel uncomfortable?
Well, two things. One is we have to get away from the strict law and order mentality that we've had for so long. And we have to start, you know, thinking that, okay, even if they're guilty, even if it's obvious that they're guilty, they still deserve legal representation and the best that they can get. There's a lot of states that either underfund or almost have no public defenders out there. If you don't have money for an attorney, you're basically out of luck. Some states that do have public defenders, they're grossly underpaid. They may have hundreds, if not thousands, of cases that they have to deal with. And the government and police agencies just have a lot more resources to work with there. So, you know, that's the one thing that, like I said, we have to start realizing that there's a process there. Well, also, there's a numbers game as well. We have to start getting away from that. Police departments, detectives are judged by the number of arrests. Prosecutors are judged, even though they don't like to admit it, by the number of convictions. And so, you know, when you, and since confessions are a very, very easy way to close a case and to get a conviction, oftentimes they're really stressed in investigations. Basically, confessions make the lazy cops, because we get the confession, we figure the deal's done, and we don't bother to do the follow-up investigation that would prevent a bad confession from getting into the courtroom to begin with.
How does that make you feel as somebody who committed your life to law and order and the justice system to realize that our system is that severely damaged?
It's frustrating, but we're making progress. It's interesting because I get a lot. The response to my work and things that I say from law enforcement is basically one of two things. For a while, when I was advocating videotaping in my own department of interrogations from start to finish, my nickname was Benedict Tranum. They thought, of course, I was a traitor. However, when you get law enforcement behind closed doors and you start talking about the things that I'm talking about, the majority, especially the younger people, the younger detectives who have seen cases, you know, things like Making a Murderer and things along that line, they're much more receptive to the things that I talk about, to the reform issues that I talk about, simply because they want to do it right. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing that's really dangerous. There's very few rogue cops out there who are intentionally trying to frame somebody and get false confessions. Most of these are done by cops, detectives, who honestly believe that this person is guilty of the crime. And because of tunnel vision and verification bias, they kind of push the envelope and they don't see that the information that they're giving them is unreliable. They don't, you know.
Right. Well, and we'll get into that aspect. We'll get into that aspect. But what do we have in place right now, James? What do we have safeguard-wise to prevent false confessions? Because it seems like they're still happening. And as you said, it's a problem. But isn't there something to make sure that this doesn't occur?
We don't have much. First off, there's Miranda. And we've already talked a little bit about Miranda.
Now, for a lot of people don't understand that. You know, most people understand Miranda from what they've seen on every cop show. It's a quick blurb of sentence. They don't even really realize the ramifications. What does Miranda really mean, and how does it impact us when we are given our Miranda rights?
Basically, what Miranda is saying is that you do not have to talk to an officer if you don't want to. There's no requirement. Second, if you do talk, there's a caution. If you do decide to talk, that whatever you say is going to be used against you. So therefore, any statement you make is not going to be to your benefit in the long run. And third, that if you do decide to talk, you can have an attorney there with you, and that attorney can counsel you. Now, no defense attorney that I know worth their salt is going to let anybody, you know, talk to a police officer about a crime that they suspect in. So, but that's the main thing. It's to let you know that what's coming, you know, that you don't have to put up with it if you don't want to. The thing about it is, like you said, on TV, it's a blurb. They read through it quickly. We are trained. We are the best salesman in the world. Miranda is nothing but a speed bump. Detectives and officers are trained in the various techniques to manipulate you to make you think that it's in your best interest. Oh, yeah, I'll cooperate. I'll waive Miranda, and that's no problem. So, like I said, but the Miranda is not really an issue. And, in fact, I had talked before about how it's only about a disability issue. And I love to bring up that behind every wrongful conviction that results from a false confession, that there's a judge that ruled that confession to be admissible. The second safeguard is a lot of departments, not all. Well,
let me ask you one thing about the Miranda. You know, I have some friends that are officers, and they say the minute you want a lawyer up, they automatically think you're guilty. And
that's
is it
the other thing? Yes.
Right. You know, what you're making sense is, you know, I've seen enough TV shows and enough documentaries and understand this now that if somebody came to me with that big of a crime, even though I'm innocent, I don't want to say anything because I don't want it to be taken out of context or misunderstood. And I would like a lawyer to be there so that I make sure that my rights are being protected. But that, in essence, makes me look even more guilty.
Yes. And we use that. We use that in our, you know, work up to Miranda. We definitely give the person that impression. And that's why innocent people are much more susceptible to waiving Miranda and undergoing these coercive interrogation techniques because they are innocent. I have nothing to hide. Sure, I'll cooperate. I'll help. They don't know what's coming down the road. They don't know that this detective is already convinced that they are guilty and is not seeking any kind of truth. They're actually seeking a confession from that person.
So in your opinion, anybody arrested for anything where your Miranda rights are called into effect, you should always request a lawyer present going forward.
My coworkers will kill me for this, but absolutely. Absolutely. As soon as you realize that you are a suspect or you're being treated as a suspect, you should get a lawyer for advice.
All right. Yeah, and I think that's an important aspect people need to be aware of, that you have that right. Use that right because, you know, you won't. What's been funny, a lot of the police officers I talk to is some of them will say, I'm not going to talk. I want my lawyer, and then spend the next 20 minutes spilling their guts on everything, even though they just said, I don't, you know, I want a lawyer. But they find that sometimes when they get that off their shoulders, they actually talk about what just happened, and then they're able to feel a little bit more relaxed about opening up on those kind of cases.
Actually, I would love to see the videotape of those interrogations that you're talking about and not just take the officer's word. I bet you that there's a little conversation before and a little conversation after that maybe push the person along a little bit more than they're willing to admit to or more that they realize is going on. So.
Really? Okay. We've got just about a minute left in this segment. I do want to ask though, do you believe that every officer, when they're doing interrogation, should start the video immediately and let it run through the entire thing to protect himself and the client to make sure that true justice is about to be served?
Absolutely. That is the only way that we can evaluate not only the interrogation tactics that were used, but how the confession was extracted, how the information came from the suspect. Did it come from them, or was it fed to them either intentionally or unintentionally by the detective? Videotaping is critical, but it does not prevent false confessions. It just gives you a way to evaluate the confession itself.
Does every police officer in every jurisdiction automatically have to videotape now?
No, it depends on the agency, on the jurisdiction, on the laws of that jurisdiction. A lot of agencies are still fighting it tooth and nail. They want nothing to do with it.
All right, James Trainum, our guest this evening, how the police generate false confessions. We'll continue talking with our guest about that. And again, what are the safeguards to prevent false confessions? Are police trained to ask questions that will put people in a vulnerable situation even when they're innocent? We'll discuss that and more, and we'll take your calls in the next hour. When we return, I'm Dave Schrader. This is Coast to Coast AM.